Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Gwendolyn Dean. Since 1998, Dean has been director of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Services Center at Cornell University. Prior to that, she was director of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual Community Center at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, and the graduate coordinator of the Office of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual Life at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the show, Gwendolyn.
Hi.
Listen, I'm really curious about something in your biography. You have degrees from the University of California at Irvine in performance art and drama, but you clearly have chosen leadership in various LGBT communities and organizations. What was that, something conscious that you decided?
It happened sort of in increments. When I finished my MFA in performance art, I think the thing that was clear to me was that I'd had this brilliant, wonderful education, kind of completely at the public expense. And I wanted to, you know, do something that really gave back. And as much as I felt that my, you know, performance art was politically charged and about social justice, you know, really, there's 12 people who watch it and half of us do it. So it's just not like I could seriously feel as, you know, as much as I loved doing that, that it was really giving much back. So I started teaching in a bilingual school in East Los Angeles.
Really?
And I did that for about 5 years and felt like I needed to know more about racism and gender and class, and looked around for a graduate program to help me with that. And it was in graduate school that I really connected with the LGBT movement and found out that I was good at it and sort of passionate about it and moved in that direction.
Oh, that's an interesting segue, I must say. Now, obviously, you know, the LGBT community has come a long way from the days when homosexuality was illegal and people were getting busted and put in jail. But do you think the one thread that continues to run through the LGBT community is the issue of the closet?
I do. And the closet has changed so much, but it's incredibly pervasive. You know, when I do trainings, often talking to a lot of straight people, you know, talking about our history, the closet used to mean it was completely about oneself, you know, had you admitted to yourself and come out of your internal closet, because we really didn't have an idea of public outness outside of a contained, you know, usually all gay male or all lesbian subculture with a little crossover. Mm-hmm. And obviously the idea has progressed hugely, and often now we don't even know what we mean when we say out.
I was going to ask you, what do we mean when we say out?
I always feel that you have to really explore what the individual is trying to say. I mean, I suspect very few people have the privilege that you and I do, which is, you know, we can pretty much tattoo our sexual orientation across our forehead. We get, you know, to be gay for pay and, you know. So I would say basically I'm out all the time in every situation except just walking around when, you know, then sort of the heterosexual presumption takes over. Most people have to negotiate every single situation, whether they're out to their family, their friends, in the workplace, each new workplace. And I think that for most people, that's the condition of outness that they live with. One thing I think that has become more common now is with, you know, the gay baby boom. I've talked to a lot of people who never really thought about being publicly out in any organized way until they put their children in school.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And they had to decide how they were going to present to mommies. Were they going to be an openly, you know, same-sex couple-headed family, or were they going to come up with some complicated story to stay in the closet? Because it's very hard when you have a child and you're presenting yourself as a family, whether, you know, whether you've actually thought through that or chosen it or not.
Mm-hmm. So some of these people were choosing in some ways to be closeted prior to their children going into the public.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how they did that.
Well, again, you know, heterosexist actual presumption is very strong. So the assumption is that we're all straight. And unless you do something to counter that, you can just sort of ride with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people, I mean, they probably wouldn't say, I'm very closeted. They'd say, yeah, I'm fairly discreet. I mean, I don't flaunt it. But being out in an organized fashion that's almost sort of political, thinking about how do you come out, what do you say, how do you present yourself. A lot of people have no reason, you know, to think of it in anything but a very personal and interpersonal way.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of major step of putting a child in school, when all of a sudden you're dealing with your family in public, with teachers, with administrators, with other parents, and also you're dealing with the fact that your child will be both educated and questioned about family structure, and you have to come to terms with how you're going to present that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also want to talk about your work. For the last 10 years, you've been the director of the LGBT Center at Cornell University. Has the focus of the center changed in the last 10 years? Well, what are some of the concerns that started, and has it evolved?
It has evolved. I think when I was first here, the center, which has been here since 1994, I'm the third coordinator, third director, was initially really inwardly focused, sort of inward to the center and inward to the community, in trying to evaluate what the needs were, provide lots of services, mostly support services, around coming out, around education, and thinking through how to deal with the wider Cornell community.
Mm.
And luckily, when I got there, I was very privileged to have a really good base laid in terms of those sorts of inward-looking things, and was able to sort of move to the next step of trying to raise the visibility of the Resource Center, raise the visibility of LGBT people and concerns on campus, and really try and start moving toward climate change and getting everyone used to the fact that we're there.
And so that does take some doing still, huh?
Some. I mean, you know, I have all good things to say about Cornell. When I got there, we had sexual orientation included in the equal opportunity policy. We had domestic partnership. I mean, a lot of those policy hurdles that a lot of my colleagues at other schools are still fighting were already done. And so that's a wonderful base to work from.
Mm-hmm.
Because the institution has already made a commitment.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the concerns that LGBT students bring to you now? Is it still closet issues? AIDS?
Always. AIDS, not so much, which I'm not sure is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know?
We have heard many reports about how people are reverting to bad, unsafe sex.
And, you know, I'm not sure that the level of awareness about HIV and STIs in general is as high as I would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of safer sex education. Students don't really bring me those concerns.
Mm.
I think that the top concern students bring are parents and family.
In regard to coming out?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are always outness issues about their roommates, their professors, and all of those. But the central issues and the ones that engage them kind of the most deeply and painfully are our parents and family issues.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of advice do you give these kids? Did you ever tell somebody to stay in the closet?
You know, I recommend outness sort of across the board. I don't think that there's any way to be in the closet and not have it have some sort of negative shaming effect, even at the subconscious level. And I know lots of people who've said, you know, that being outed, which I'm not recommending, ended up being a positive experience for them. They were glad to be out and wished that it had happened a different way, but that being out was good. Having said all that, I am not sure that causing a major family crisis when one is trying to get a college education is necessarily the best advice. So it's pretty much the only situation in which I say, please don't go home for Christmas and tell your parents.
Really?
And, you know, and for the most part, they do not listen to me. And, you know, I really would like parents to grasp that the reason they do these things, and sometimes parents are very upset, you know, Christmas dinner will never be the same again because you
Nor
said you were
Christmas, right? The whole atmosphere has been ruined. By
right. You said you were gay in front of grandma and, you know, and I think what I've been able to figure out that what motivates young people to do these things in this, what their parents will say are not well thought out ways, is their really deep desire to have a genuine relationship with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
because otherwise there is no reason for it. And what they talk about as the motivating factor is as they come to terms with a same-sex orientation and incorporate that into their daily lives, they find that the editing they have to do, talking to parents that they have been very close to before, is really painful, and that they can't maintain it, and they feel like they're losing what had been a very genuine emotional connection to their parents, and that the only way to get it back is to tell their parents the truth, which is why I think it comes blurting out, because I'll try and give them practical advice like, you know, wait, think it through, and they just can't. Mm-hmm. But the impulse to that, I think, is wholly positive and really family-oriented.
Oh, I'm sure. Are a lot of kids that come to you at Cornell are already out, and that's not an issue? Or do people generally come out at this age of, what, 19, 18, 19, 20?
You know, people are coming out younger and younger. I have more students every year who hit campus their first year, and they've been out in high school. They started their GSA. You know, endearingly, I have parents call me up or come in on prospective tours and say, my child has been out since, you know, he or she was 13 years old, and I want to know if they're going to be okay here. And I had that happen to both Stanford and Cornell. And I felt really good about being able to say, well, yes, I think they will be. That's starting to happen with trans students now. We have added gender expression and identity to our equal opportunity policy. And before this entering freshman class, we had a parent inquire as to whether their transsexual child was going to be okay at Cornell.
Wow, so that's amazing. Things have changed.
Things are changing.
For the better, I must say. Now, I've talked to quite a few of my African-American friends about this issue, and that is that on the surface, racism seems to be getting better in our culture, but a lot of African-American friends of mine say it's just not as upfront and the prejudice is still simmering and stuff. Do you feel that way about homophobia as well? Are people just being PC, in other words?
It's complicated. Familiarity is the most important thing. And I think at some point this was true with race. I have African-American friends, and my stepfather is African-American, and living in California, I know people would say things may have been not as good in the South, but at least people had seen black people, so they didn't react to, oh my God, look, there's an African-American person.
Exactly.
And, you know, I had a number of African-American friends say, and that was just more comfortable, you know, the familiarity, even if there were still problems, just let me live my life a little more easily. And I think that's still what we're wrestling with sexual orientation. You know, pretty well every study that's ever been done said, you know, more than education, race, gender, class, religion, the thing that tells whether a straight person is most likely to be open or tolerant of LGBT people is whether they know them.
Mm.
And which, you know, circles back around
to
the outness.
The closet. Yeah, exactly.
And you know, more and more of us are out, and we're getting more media coverage, which I absolutely know is problematic. But, you know, the familiarity piece.
Well, in what way is it problematic?
Oh, I don't mind it as much as a lot of people do. But, you know, with any marginalized group where we have limited representation, people really want to be represented as they really are in what they feel is sort of a wholesome and positive manner.
Mm-hmm.
So there's endless sort of discussions that we're not like those people on Queer as Folk, and, you know, I don't see my family, and Will and Grace are so stereotyped. And none of these things are untrue, but I'm also just not sure that any single representation can carry a whole population and represent them positively. So I think there's an up and down, you know, to the media representation. My view is that it's mostly an up, because familiarity is the first step toward tackling any of the deeper simmering things. We have to get people to the point. You know, I think the fact that people who are incredibly anti-LGBT can say gay marriage without a second thought, that's progress. A, it wasn't that many years ago that they couldn't say gay. Lesbian's
still
a problem.
People have a hard time with lesbian.
I know, but we've gotten gay down. And the other thing is, they have to be against it. You know, I have to say, 10 years ago, same-sex marriage was a joke.
Even in the LGBT community, I mean, a lot of people said we don't want that kind of a role model for our lives. Marriages are, you know, traps, and I still hear that from people.
I have to say, I am of the generation that tends to say, wow, I had no idea that being a radical queer activist would have me talking about getting married and serving in the military all the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gwendolyn Dean. She's the director of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Services Center at Cornell University. What do you think of the fact that Ellen DeGeneres has done so much for the LGBT community? Don't you think? I have so many people who tell me that they find her so compellingly nice and a great role model and just a sweet person, and it has helped them get over the stereotypes. Well, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that's great, and I think that Ellen is obviously incredibly funny and incredibly engaging. I always have issues when people say, get over the stereotypes.
Mm.
And the one thing that I think has really brought that home to me is working with transgender people, because more so than dealing with gender or race or sexual orientation, people ask me if some stereotype is true, and really want me to sort of go into long descriptions of why it isn't. And I guess what I'd like to know is, haven't we learned from being wrong all the other times? You know, haven't we learned from, you know, feminism and the civil rights movement that all those stereotypes were wrong?
Yeah, but a lot of them are based on truth. I mean, there were butch femmes and, you know, I mean, that kind of thing. And male-looking females in the LGBT community and effeminate men. And
sure.
You know, I mean, those stereotypes are all based on truth. It's just that it's being used as an example of the whole community often.
And, you know, probably you could say that about many stereotypes, is that they're
all
based on some truth.
Yes.
But just because many women do something, you know, we know at this point that saying all women do that is ridiculous. And I think if anything depresses me in terms of where we're going in social justice is that I see us tackling each new issue of inclusion as though we've never done it before.
I can understand being upset by that. Now, there's something I want to touch on, too. You do anti-heterosexism trainings. Tell us about that.
Well, people call them lots of different things. I mean, I prefer the word heterosexism to homophobia, so that's what I use. But, you know, that ranges from LGBT 101 or 101A to more complicated kinds of issues around creating affirming workplaces, creating affirming residences. I've done issues particularly on sexual orientation and religion. We try to be a sort of one-stop shopping at the resource center. So pretty much if somebody wants to know something and I have the resources or the background, we'll do a workshop or a training or a presentation for them.
I see. Because when I first saw that term, I was thinking it has to do with the fact that there's a prejudice and everybody assumes everybody is heterosexual.
Well, that's certainly part of it. We have this tendency to say that homophobia is sort of name-calling and violence and sort of the stupid blatant stuff. And then we're not even sure what we're talking about on the other end. And so I would use heterosexism the way we use racism or sexism so that it covers the whole spectrum. The idea that sort of homophobia ends and nothing else is really a problem. Mm. Again, you know, historically we've learned that the obvious things that we tackled in racism and sexism, a lot of those we've taken care of. But prejudice is amazingly sort of flexible and amorphous, and it comes around and finds new ways to exist, which is why I think it's important to keep the whole spectrum in mind, which is why I try and use heterosexism to keep people's awareness that just being heterocentric and assuming that everyone is heterosexual is part of the same spectrum as gay bashing. It's not the same activity, but it's part of the same phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have noticed wandering through my life, everybody does assume one's straight. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen nights at bars, and you know, you assume that you're going to bring a male or a female with you. And, yeah, it's prevalent. It hasn't changed. That hasn't changed that much. I have to admit.
Yep.
Now, you're the facilitator of a transgender support group at Cornell.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Tell us about that. How has the transgender community, if you will, or the transgender identity changed through the years? Is it more accepted? Because it seems like a minority within a minority. It always was when I lived in San Francisco 10 years ago.
Well, yes and no. And some of it's definitional and some of it's historic. Transgender includes more than just transsexual people. And say, you know, you were mentioning butch lesbians or very Nelly gay men.
Mm-hmm.
Some people who have those identities think that fits in a transgender spectrum and some don't.
Oh,
so there's always been a huge range of gender expression within the LGBT community. And, you know, it's not that unusual to say, but, you know, remember Stonewall? Those were butch lesbians and drag queens. You know, they were the forefront of what's considered to be the pivotal moment in the modern gay rights movement. And you know, there's a reason for that, which is they were also the most excluded, you know, least able to assimilate, most oppressed, you know, part of our community.
Mm-hmm.
But that piece of the community has always been there. And there's always been a lot of tension to go back to people being concerned about stereotypes. When you said, you know, people do fit stereotypes. Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, you know, there's a wider variety of us is really different from, unfortunately, what I think a lot of people have done, which is to say, and people who fit the stereotype are a bad representation of the community.
Oh, yes.
So trans people cover a wide range of behaviors and also understanding. One of the things that I would say has changed about the transgender community in the years I've been working on these issues is their own understanding. You know, gender identity as a concept is really still evolving.
It's fluid, isn't it?
For some people, it's fluid,
mm-hmm.
but it's also sexual orientation is fluid for some people.
Uh-huh.
And for some people, it's not. It's very concrete, mm-hmm. very defined, and it never shifts. And that in itself, I think, is confusing, not just for people with very standard sexual orientations and gender identities, but even people within the LGBT community. If you have a very concrete orientation or identity, some people are not just confused, but actually hostile to the idea that other people who are supposed to be like them experience their orientation or identity as very fluid,
mm-hmm.
you know, even within our own community.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of concerns do the transgender communities bring to these support groups?
A lot of it is isolation, which is a similar concern to LGBT students. The support group I'm working with is all traditional student age individuals dealing with their parents, dealing with partners, people who are figuring out their identity, considering transition, various things. You know, whether they have, it's confusing to say whether they have a same sex or other sex partner. But if you're someone who identifies as a lesbian and you're in a relationship with someone that you consider to be a woman and you consider yourself in a lesbian relationship, and that person says, oh, by the way, honey, I'm actually a guy.
that is confusing, isn't it?
Well, it's their issue, but it's also the partner's issue, because it depends on how the partner's going to relate to how they define lesbian, how they feel about, you know. And so things can get very complicated in trying to sort those issues out.
Mm-hmm.
Some very practical things, you know, do you have a good endocrinologist and is it easy to get testosterone? And there's a lot of sort of practical trading of information, recommendations about which therapists and which physicians are good to see, what services in general are open to trans-identified people.
Mm-hmm.
So a range of concerns, pretty much what you would expect, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I would think so, too. Now, it says in your biography that you're interested in feminist theory and queer studies.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that.
Okay.
How have those issues evolved? We were talking earlier about the fact that is feminism still a theory, right?
Yeah, well, it's sort of, you know, there's to every academic field, there's a more theoretical aspect and a less theoretical one. And I think that, you know, we have tended to have women's studies and feminist theory. And you know, in some ways, there's been sort of an academic value judgment attached to that, which is that feminist theory is the real academic piece, whereas women's studies is, you know, they're probably still doing consciousness raising like they did back in the 70s. And to some degree, I think that exists, you know, in LGBT studies or queer studies. We talk about queer theory, which, you know, due to Judith Butler and the other sort of academic rock stars have made, you know, the solidly academically respected piece. Whereas, yeah, I don't know, LGBT studies and history, that's just trying to make people feel better about themselves. So I think that those fields have similar dynamics in terms of theory, practice. What are we really trying to do here? Do hard academic work or empower communities, I think is the tension.
Hmm. Now, you're also interested in lesbians and contemporary mystery novels. Which
Yes.
We only have a couple more minutes. I find that extremely interesting. Talk to me about that.
Well, sort of briefly, I mean, of course, we all know that, you know, our own presses, we have lots of genres of lesbian mystery novels and lesbian romances. But when I was in grad school, I got interested in the idea that because of the structure of the genre of the mystery novel, it in some ways is really facilitating to marginalized groups.
Mm.
And because it's all about good and evil, and your typical detective wants to uphold justice but is often outside the law. And so there's all these like very embedded ethical concerns. And a number of lesbian detectives, some written by lesbian-identified authors and some not, have crossed over into mainstream publications, readerships, and I was really interested in looking at those. You know, Sandra Scopitone originally was read mostly by a lesbian audience, but mm-hmm. crossed over into the mainstream. J.M. Redmond's last book, no, actually 2 books ago, was published by a mainstream press. And then Laurie King writes a wonderful, very complicated lesbian detective, and as far as I know, does not identify as lesbian. And it's interesting to see she's a best-selling author.
So we have come a long way in regard to mystery novels.
Well, I think it's not as trivial as that sounds.
No. But it's true, though. I mean, the fact that these kinds of things can go into the mainstream is quite compelling.
And that was unthinkable not that long ago.
Exactly. Well, we're almost out of time. How can people get in touch with you or the center?
You can call the center at 607-254-4987 or email me at gd35@cornell.edu.
Well, we have run out of time. Gwendolyn, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.